Coming up right now is the two-hour version of Animal Voices. And to introduce the show, one of our hyena friends is going to give us a little commentary on what they think of the new government's environmental policies.
Hyena was laughing at me, not you. Hi, this is Animal Voices, where we envision a world where the human race will finally make peace with the animal kingdom. We envision a world where human beings will no longer kill, maim, torture, and exploit fellow beings for food or any other purpose. We recognize that animals have fundamental rights, and these rights include that they be treated with compassion and mercy, and that they should be accorded many of the rights that human beings expect to be able to take for granted. We know that one day these fundamental animal rights will be internationally recognized. Like all of us, animals are capable of suffering, and they are not ours to use for food or clothing, entertainment, experimentation, or any other reason. Welcome, everyone, to Animal Voices, coming to you on CFRO Radio 102.7 FM in Vancouver, also known as Co-op Radio, member-supported radio, your listener-sponsored radio station. We can be heard live on the Internet at www.cooperadio.org, and you can catch our archive programs on the Animal Voices webpage, which is www.animalvoices.org. Well, in the first half of our show today, we're going to have, we have in our studio Sarah Murphy, who's a student at the UBC in the Animal Welfare Program. She's going to tell us all about her research paper, master's degree research paper on cosmetic surgery in animals, such as tail docking and ear cropping. And in the second half of the program, we're going to be talking to Thelma McAdams, who is a longtime activist for pesticide reduction and has worked for the Health Action Network Society located here in Vancouver in their pesticide reduction program. Well, we had a couple of announcements before we start. Today is actually National Fur Day, and I think that's what it's called. Let's see. It's a news release from Liberation BC, which is located in Surrey, BC here. And that's Ashley Fruno at hotmail.com, Ashley_Fruno@hotmail.com for more information. And the news release says, "Have a heart, don't wear fur." And local activists are targeting retailer Tristan in America for National Anti-Fur Day. That's tonight. On National Anti-Fur Day, local animal rights group Liberation BC will join other animal protection groups in 22 cities across Canada, including Toronto, Montreal, Halifax, Ottawa, Winnipeg, Edmonton, Calgary, and Victoria, in urging consumers not to buy or wear real fur or fur trim. Liberation BC in particular is asking clothing retailer Tristan in America to have a heart and to stop selling fur. The group plans to pressure the company by bringing graphic images of the fur industry directly to shoppers. Liberation BC will also have a body TV screen showing the public shocking footage of animals on fur farms. They will also be holding signs that will read, "Tristan in America, Profits from Pain." The group plans to use these materials to educate potential Tristan shoppers to shun the retail chain until they go fur-free. So that's Friday, today, at noon. I'm sorry, at 1 o'clock, so right after this show. And the place is the Pacific Center, which is at the intersection of Robson and Howe. That's today at 1 o'clock, Pacific Center, intersection of Robson and Howe. You can contact Ashley Fruno, who is the campaign organizer for Liberation BC, If you want to call her phone, it's 604-230-2837. That's 230-2837.
Friday.
Today. And another a little public service announcement here is you can celebrate Kissing Day, I guess it's for Valentine's, and raise funds for the Vancouver Humane Society and share some love and help animals. You can join them for some prizes and live entertainment with British rockers Radio 1, who will cover some of Britain's finest exports, including the Beatles, Radiohead, and Coldplay. Astrological love readings and a kissing booth will also be available for your enjoyment by donation. And that is March 2nd, that's next month, on March 2nd, at The Cellar, which is 1006 Granville Street at Nelson. And the doors open at 9 a.m. Tickets are only $10, and that includes one free drink, and the tickets must be sold in advance. Space is limited, so book your tickets today. You can call the Vancouver Humane Society to charge by phone, 604-266-9744. Also coming up is a Dance for the Future of Organic Farming by Marius. And this is a the fifth annual Chicken and Egg Dance. And it's to be held February 11th, that would be tomorrow, at from 6 till 11 p.m., 6 in the evening till 11 p.m., at the Capri Hall, which is at 3925 Fraser Street at King Edward. So that's 3925 Fraser Street at King Edward. And you can show your local organic farmers how much you love them and the food they grow for you. So help our organic friends of the future raise funds to support alternatives to factory farming. Now, Marge, you have a little notice as well, eh?
Oh, yes. I had a call from a friend of the show, Jenna Hunt, just this morning. And she was suffering because she had lost her cat. And the cat was injured and seemed to be on the mend for the last couple of weeks. And she was very optimistic that he was going to survive. And unfortunately, last Tuesday, he died. And so we send out our condolences to Jenna, and we're hoping that she will be back on our show one day. Jenna asked that we remind our listeners that they should be very much aware of animals when they're driving. Cats, raccoons, skunks, and other urbanized animals in the city could easily dart out in front of the car, so that please drive carefully.
Thanks, Marge, and our condolences to Jenna. Well, we'll be right back with our first guest in just one moment.
Hello, this is Marge Adams, and my guest today is Sarah Murphy. Sarah graduated from Concordia University with a degree in anthropology, and she is now taking graduate studies at the University of British Columbia in the Animal Welfare Program. Welcome to Animal Voices, Sarah.
Thanks, Marge.
The topic of your master's thesis is ear cropping and tail docking of dogs. Now, can you tell us why you decided to study this issue?
Well, coming from a cultural anthropology background, I wanted to look at the way different cultural norms impact the ways that we treat animals. And this issue I felt was interesting to look at because currently there are many countries where ear cropping and tail docking have been banned. So in Europe, these practices have been banned, as well as Australia and New Zealand, where in Canada, it still remains the standard for many breeds to have ears cropped and tails docked, as well as in the United States. In the United States, you cannot show a dog who isn't cropped or docked, depending on the breed. And in Canada, we're sort of on the fence where you can do it or not, but it may affect your standing in the show ring. So
I see. And so are you comparing these different cultural norms in the countries that have differences in this behavior of cropping or docking?
Not necessarily looking across across cultures, across countries, but I was looking at different sort of subcultural groups in Canada. So I did a number of interviews with veterinarians and with dog show judges, breeders, dog breeders, of course, and then just dog owners. And some of the dog owners I spoke with just had pets, and then others were show dog people who are.
I see. Could you maybe you could tell us a little bit about the history of the cropping and docking?
Okay. Well, essentially, what it is so tail docking is when a puppy, usually they do it very young, a puppy has his tail removed, and so usually they'll use scalpel, scissors, clamps, and with the ears, then they cut the ears off. And the reason traditionally and historically that they did this was for working dogs or hunting dogs or fighting dogs. And it was sort of a precautionary measure against injury. So say a dog was hunting boar, they would have the ears removed in case the boar were to attack the dog. And another argument that is made for working dogs and hunting dogs is if they're running through the brush, they could injure their tails. So it was basically a precautionary measure. Historically.
I see. Is there any real justification today for carrying these on, do you think?
Well, the original reasons are not necessarily relevant for many breeds. There are not a lot of working breeds. Like if you think of the Yorkshire Terrier, this used to be a working dog but is no longer. However, there are breeders who will make the argument that for certain breeds, there are welfare, health, and hygiene reasons to dock tails and crop ears, while veterinarians will dispute this fact generally. And those are just the general opinions of the group.
It's probably done more for show purposes, isn't it?
For breeders and dog owners that in my study that I spoke with, and I mostly was speaking with urban dwellers, so I wasn't out in the country where there are more working dogs. But yeah, for the most part, it's being done for the show and for the appearance and to meet breed standards. And breeders feel that it is necessary to meet breed standards.
Now, is there a good chance that these breed standards will be changed? Because these shows in other countries, I guess, do not require that if the practices are not allowed.
Yeah, and in Australia and in European shows, the standard has changed. So now you see Rottweilers with long, full tails, and you see Great Danes and Boxers with floppy ears and long tails. So the standard could change. But I think a lot of the people involved in the show world are very traditional, and they abide by the traditions, and I don't think that they are so much willing to change. They feel that these traditions they feel that it's important, and they believe in their practices.
Have you investigated it at all? And it wouldn't be right on target, I suppose, to be doing this, but why the changes were made in the other countries? Were the pressure groups, perhaps?
According to some of the breeders I spoke with, yes. And they were not happy about that. And so apparently there were some pressure groups. There were sort of people who were concerned with the welfare implications of these procedures and basically, I guess, public attitudes and beliefs that these aren't necessary practices.
And what are the implications for the animal?
Well, several arguments could be made. First of all, it's an amputation of the tail is obviously something that would be painful for a puppy. However, there are misconceptions that young dogs don't feel pain. So that's one argument is just the pain and the unnecessary infliction of these procedures. And also there's sort of an attitude that perhaps we shouldn't alter dogs or animals at all. So aside from the pain that it might be just wrong and that the integrity of the animal is compromised. And then there's the question of communication, and dogs use tails and ears as communication symbols for communication with humans and with other dogs. So those are three of the main arguments sort of against these procedures.
It might even hamper the hearing of the dog, I would think, to chop off its ears, wouldn't it?
I'm not sure that it would affect the hearing, but it may be possible that they could be more likely to have something get in their ear. But no, it's not impacting the actual ear canal. So.
Oh, yeah. Now, veterinarians in some cases object, you mentioned.
There are a lot of veterinarians who are not comfortable performing these procedures, and with the vets who I spoke with, many of them will not. If they're asked to, they just will not. Some of them won't even work with breeders, and some of them will try to convince dog owners not to put their dogs through these procedures. However, there are some vets who will still dock tails and crop ears.
It's not an ethical issue, though, within the veterinary community, I guess. Otherwise, maybe the organization would be encouraging vets not to.
Yeah, I suppose it depends on who you're speaking to, but I'm sure there are vets out there who do feel that there are ethical issues with performing these procedures, and there are vet associations who have come out and said that, you know, they don't agree with these procedures. The procedures aren't being taught in vet schools.
That's a pretty good indication, isn't it?
Yeah.
That's a decision within the faculty of the vet school, each vet school, I guess.
And I'm not sure that these procedures have been taught for quite a while. There was one veterinarian I spoke with who's been in practice for 33 years, and he was never taught in vet school. So I think it's something that vets learn on the job. And they are fairly straightforward and simple procedures, and this is why we have breeders and laypersons performing these procedures at home.
Which is dangerous, I suppose, to the animal.
Yes. It's. Any surgical procedure dealing with tissue is something that should be left to people who are trained.
Yeah. Now, are there any movements afoot to stop this from animal welfare groups, perhaps? Because it does seem really quite unnecessary, and I don't think a dog is any more beautiful myself. I love to see them with their full tails and their full ears. It bothers me otherwise.
Any groups specifically? I'm sure that there are many people within welfare groups that are concerned with these procedures.
Mm-hmm.
And I know within breed clubs there tend to be one or two breeders who sort of want the standard to change, and they speak up, but they're not necessarily, it's not necessarily the norm.
Yes.
So.
But now in the United States, it's practiced widely.
Yes, yeah. As it is here.
Yeah,
as well.
That's what I was thinking. Sometimes the very forceful animal welfare groups in the U.S. get things rolling, and then they kind of come into Canada.
Yeah, I'm wondering there's none that I'm aware of that are really sort of pushing this issue.
Interesting.
But it is, the procedures are so common that there are many dog owners who will purchase a dog thinking that the dog was born this way because the tails are docked at such a young age. So I think the public at large, some people just don't realize.
Mm-hmm.
They think that, oh, their little Yorkshire Terrier just has a short tail.
I see. Now, Carl, you have a question?
Well, I'm trying to look at some of the other species, and I see that the tails and the ears perform quite different functions.
Mm-hmm.
Like the leopard uses the tail as a balancing mechanism when it's traveling at great speed, and mm-hmm. so does the monkey use its tail to maybe hang on to the howler monkey certainly does, use it as a fifth arm. So there's that whole natural aspect which is being destroyed, but that's the tails. But it also protects the rear part, which is quite sensitive, mm-hmm. and there are no eyes over there, they say.
Mm-hmm.
And the other aspect of the rabbit is the rabbit, of course, which is that the blood flows through the ear, and it is a cooling mechanism for the rabbit's system in hot days. So that just reinforces what you're saying, and that I think that the unnaturalness needs to be explored and emphasized. Do you agree?
Well, I do feel that the integrity of the dog is compromised, and there are some individuals I've spoken with who have made the argument that dogs do need their tails for balance. And one breeder I spoke with who has a herding breed, he works with a herding breed, and this breed has their tails traditionally docked. And he was telling me the original reason for the dock was so that if the dog was herding sheep, and then saw a rabbit and went to veer off, well, without its tail, it would just fall over if it tried to move so quickly. So they docked the tails so that the dogs had to stay herding. And I mean, I don't know if that's true. It was an anecdotal story. But this is a longtime breeder of a herding dog who said, you know, we dock the tails so that they can't just take off really quickly. They'll lose their balance.
Yeah.
So, and I mean, the breeders, they know their breeds. And so perhaps the anecdotal stories are...
Mm-hmm. Possibly. It doesn't sound like it was a very kind action on the part of the owner to do that to the dog so he'd fall over just for the sake of the owner, really.
Yeah.
That's the trouble. It does seem to be a very much one-sided gain, doesn't it, without the animal under consideration. What is your own opinion on this, or do you have one at the moment? Are you open to either side?
I feel that these practices are going to continue, whether veterinarians perform these procedures or not. I feel that there are breeders who believe that this is the right thing to do for their breed, mm-hmm. and that if they can't find a vet to do it, they'll find someone to do it. So I feel that perhaps if the standards are not going to change, that veterinarians should continue to perform them so that we know they're being performed safely and properly.
I see. Now, the major force behind this, I suppose, is breeders, isn't it?
Well, it's the breed standards. So the breeders, the breeders want to abide by breed standards. They feel that that's important, and they want to win at the dog show. So if they feel that the judges will prefer the procedures... And if the standard calls for the procedures, then they are going to go for the procedures. Now, if the breed clubs, the Canadian Kennel Club, decides from the top to say, okay, no more, then the breeders will have to go with that. So I think the driving force is the breed standards and the control of the standards.
I see. And eventually the law would probably be changed if there was if the breeders changed their demands, there would be no reason to continue the operations.
Yeah, if the standards didn't call for it, then it wouldn't be done.
Yeah, it's just a success in the ring, mm-hmm. and well, it means a lot of money to people, doesn't it, to win these shows?
Yeah, because then with a champion dog, you can make more money off of the puppies. So. Yeah,
I see. Now, if people want to pursue this issue further, is there anywhere they can get more information on it?
Well, there's a lot of information on the web. There's actually a group of breeders out of the UK, and they believe that these procedures are very important for the welfare of certain breeds, and they're the Coalition of Docked Breeds. So you can look up their website, and that's www.coalitionofdockedbreeds.com.
And you said they believe that the operations are very important.
Yes, these are breeders who are concerned with tail injuries and basically tail injuries. They're concerned with, and they feel that certain breeds, if not docked at a young age, will have tail injuries later in life and that this can cause a lot of trauma for the dogs. And I'm not sure how much validity there is to this, but the breeders do know their breeds. Definitely. As far as the veterinarians I spoke to, their opinions are that they are seeing more cats with broken tails than dogs with broken tails. Mm-hmm. So,
well, are there certain breeds of dogs that you are aware of that do have more problems with broken tails?
None that I'm aware of.
Seems odd, doesn't it?
Yeah.
An odd argument.
Yeah. None that I'm aware of.
Right. Now, is there anything else that we should mention on this topic?
Not that I can think of.
Mm-hmm. Okay, well, thank you so much for informing us. It's a topic we've never covered before on the show, and it is a concern, I think, to a lot of people, and I for one, rather negatively disposed to the operations. So thank you, Sarah, for coming in, and you have been listening to an interview with Sarah Murphy, who's from the Animal Welfare Program at the University of British Columbia, and she has been telling us about what her studies have uncovered regarding ear cropping and tail docking in dogs.
good afternoon. We're back with Animal Voices, 102.7 FM, CFRO in Vancouver. A recent study from the University of Colorado made headlines when it was reported that a soy-based diet worsened heart disease in male mice, carrying a mutation for hypertrophic cardiomyopathy. Can you say that? Hypertrophic cardiopathy? Cardiomyopathy, HCM for short. In humans, HCM is a congenital heart disease involving abnormal thickening of the left ventricle walls. It is the leading cause of death in young athletes and affects about 1 in 500 people. And there's a considerable body of published research concerning soy's benefits to human health, including cancer prevention and lower blood pressure and cholesterol and improved bone density. Even skeptical nutrition experts say that soy is beneficial if for no other reason than that it displaces less healthy fare like hamburgers and hot dogs. And since 1999, the U.S. Food and Drug Administration has allowed companies to tout a cholesterol-lowering benefit on soy-based food labels. Well, the mice in the Colorado study had to endure harmful genetic manipulation, barren cages, which incidentally afford scant opportunities for exercise, and a host of painful and stressful procedures, physical restraint, abdominal injections, removal of ovaries or testicles, surgical implantation of hormone pellets into the neck, and killing. And the method was not divulged. But the question then bears asking, why are mice subjected to all this to try to shed light on effects to humans, to human health, that could be addressed with reliable and ethical human clinical investigations? It adds insult to injury that the study was then published in the Journal of Clinical Investigation. There's nothing clinical about this study. It's entirely experimental and on another species. So a dietary analysis of HCM patients, that's hypertrophic cardiomyopathy patients, would reveal any possible interaction with soy, avoiding feeble extrapolations from mice to men. My search of the PubMed database suggests that little or no effort has yet been made to address clinically any relationship between dietary soy and hypertrophic cardiomyopathy. And the reason the University of Colorado study made a media splash is not because it makes a valuable contribution to human medicine, though sadly that is the impression many readers get. Rather, it is that the results contradict well-established benefits of soy in humans. The lead author on the mouse study commented to the press that, "I don't think normal, healthy people should be alarmed by the results of this study. What we should be alarmed about is that this sort of thing is regarded as useful ethical science." And that essay was by Jonathan Balcombe, who's a PhD and is a PCRM research scientist. That's Physicians Committee for Responsible Medicine, based in Washington, D.C. He's a research scientist with a background in ethology. He's the author of The Use of Animals in Higher Education, as well as many scientific papers on humane life science education and animal behavior. His recent scientific review showing that animal experiments are more stressful than previously understood was published in Contemporary Topics in Laboratory Animal Science, and a forthcoming review in Laboratory Animals reveals how laboratory housing thwarts rodents' behavioral needs, and this, of course, makes the studies even less reliable. His new book, Pleasurable Kingdom, Animals and the Nature of Feeling Good, is due out in May of 2006, and we'll be right back with Thelma McAdams. Thelma McAdams is a longtime activist for pesticide reduction and has worked for the Health Action Network Society in their pesticide reduction program. Good afternoon, Thelma. How are you?
Hi.
Hi, Thelma. How are you?
Good. Thank you.
Thanks for coming on the show today.
Oh, you're welcome. pleasure.
Well, now, the definition of a pest, as I understand it, is anything that's not wanted. What is the definition of a pesticide, then? I mean, that could be pretty broad, couldn't it?
Very broad. Yeah,
I mean, indeed. It could kill just about anything you want it to have killed.
Yeah, right.
So there's nothing specific about these pesticides, and yet people are using them as if, you know, it's going to kill only the dandelion and nothing else. Is that the fact?
Oh, this is what they'd like you to believe, that it just targets that one weed that you're dying to kill, and you are going to die in the process if you're using the pesticides. Believe me, they are very, very dangerous to everybody.
So we can't trust the government, which has declared these substances safe.
Listen, I checked the nursery shelves and any store that was selling pesticides a year or so ago and found that the labeling is absolutely, totally inadequate. These are pesticides that are petroleum distillates. And you'll find that in the automotive industry, they're all labeled with the poison label and the skull and crossbones, which pesticides are supposed to be too, and they don't do it.
Well, benzene is a known human carcinogen, isn't it?
Oh, yes.
So the fact that these are based on benzene compounds is certainly an indication of great danger to us.
Well, if they can sell their byproducts, which pesticides actually are from the oil and gas industry, and make a big profit by putting them into smaller containers and charging bigger prices, of course their profit picture is going to look pretty nice. But meanwhile, people are totally uninformed about what they're doing.
Well, Health Canada is not regulating these things very well if it comes out later that these substances cause all sorts of damage, whether environmental or whether it's damage to human health. But in the meantime, we get this tremendous flow of chemicals onto the market daily, and it's all run through animal bodies and then declared safe because it's safe for rats or mice or some other species of animals. And it's thrown onto the market, and it's really just a gigantic experiment on human beings and on environmental factors, including all the animals, of course, that live with us.
On the whole world, actually. But, you know, the animal studies are often so fraudulent, and to say nothing of the fact that there are some of the chemicals like thiazinamide did not show any effects on rats, and look what it did to human babies.
You said thalidomide, did you?
Thalidomide,
uh-huh.
Yes.
Yeah.
And there are, like, let's take aspirin. Now, animal studies are fraudulent, and, you know, are, shall we say, misdirected on that, and wouldn't be trustworthy when, look at the aspirin that's used by people, and yet it would kill a cat.
Yes.
So, you know, works both ways. It's just not a reliable science.
And inconclusive, and it takes a long time, as we discussed before, and that, so that allows these companies to keep them on the market for many years before anything is done about it, is that right?
That's what they like to do, because the animal studies take years and years, whereas there are other studies that could take weeks.
Such as? The Ames test, for example?
The Ames test, uh-huh. And the chicken embryo test.
Really?
They could... Sorry.
You're on, yeah.
The chicken embryo test would have shown what thalidomide did.
Really?
In 3 weeks instead of in years.
And instead what they did, what the manufacturer did was, you know, they marketed under, I don't know, 100 names or so in different countries, and they said, they gave the assurance that it was perfectly safe for mother and child.
Right.
And they had tested, I think Time Magazine said that thalidomide was launched onto the market after 3 years of intensive studies on animals.
Oh,
and,
yeah.
And there was no damage to animals. So what happened? 10,000 babies were born without arms and limbs or terribly deformed arms and limbs.
And you know what an emotional and physical impact that is on people.
Oh.
I'm very alarmed about the fact that they're struggling very hard to get some cosmetic bans, at least, you know, for the cosmetic use of herbicides on lawns, which is one of our major exposures to children and pets.
Mm-hmm.
Now, people forget that these are actually able to cause cancer, And look at how many animals now that are pets and very dearly loved by all their owners. They walk them on the streets that have lawns that are sprayed with the chemicals like 2,4-D. And then they wonder why they're dying.
Well, we saw what a fuss was made over the police dog who died and the hoopla and all that, but yet this broad poisoning of animals is ignored, isn't it? It's so strange, our psychotic or our schizophrenic attitude towards these matters.
Well, the thing is that it's very hard to make the chemical connection,
mm-hmm.
and the chemical companies know that. They hide behind the fact that they can use these things, and it may take years for the results to fully show up, and by then, of course, how are you going to make the connection when you don't even know what you were exposed to?
Yeah.
You know, it's been a wonderful thing for the hiding the insidious use of these chemicals in our environment, but it's very, very has been very hazardous to particularly our children.
We did an interview a couple of weeks ago now with a representative from PETA, who they have a campaign against the EPA and against the World Wildlife Fund, by the way, who are pushing to retest thousands of chemicals that have appeared on the market without adequate testing, according to them, or no testing at all. But the whole procedure is going to be exactly a duplicate of what it was done in the first place, namely animal tests, and millions of animals are going to
yeah.
suffer cruel and horrible deaths, and the manufacturer is going to have their stuff stay on the market, and nothing's going to change.
Oh, that's the sad truth about it. If people only knew just how deceptive the government is being about this, Health Canada is certainly not on our side.
No, well, they're pushing Terminator seeds all over the place, and every kind of toxic procedure they seem to be in favor of, and organics is derided and suppressed.
That is true, and I keep hoping that the public are going to just plain not let it happen anymore, but it seems to be a very slow process.
Well, do you think it's the bureaucracy, or do you think our newly installed government is going to change things? After all, they are for reform. What do you think?
Wouldn't that be nice? I would love to know that they were going to actually take steps to protect the health and safety of us all,
yeah.
The animals and the kids and the adults. But 2,4-D is not labeled as being dangerous. And the landscapers are going to fight it tooth and nail to try and keep it on the market so they can use it.
Yep.
And this is where the pressure has to come on people to go to their governments, be it municipal, provincial, or federal, and demand that these procedures are not kept up, because the precautionary principle is what we should be operating under, and that was put through on a worldwide level at the Helsinki conference years ago, that they made an amendment that the precautionary principle, which means you do not use anything that has the possibility of harm, has to be proven.
Well, Carl... I'm sorry, Carl is Carl Loskin, you know, is engaged too in a fight with the companies and the golf course in North Van, and trying to get a ban, I think it is, on pesticide use in North Vancouver. He'd like to tell you about it.
Yes, well, I know, Thelma, that you've been working with this pesticide issue for so many years, and that you've been successful in the Coquitlam, or is it Port Moody area,
to have meaningful
legislation.
Yes.
But what we're struggling with in North Vancouver is that they want to have exclusions for certain groups, which includes, of course, the golf courses and the lawn care people. And when I say lawn care, there's two inverted commas there. But what is the position in Port Moody?
Well, the Port Moody have got the education factor going, that they're educating, trying to educate people to use alternative methods.
Mm-hmm.
And they do have a fine. It is very minimal. They don't want to enforce it by fine if they can help it. But it is the first step. It's a cosmetic use, which means they cannot use it on flower beds or lawns, which is what the landscapers are really banding together to try to keep it on the market.
Now, Thelma, we were having an education program. In fact, it's going to be this coming Wednesday on the district of North Vancouver. People can look it up at dnv.org. And one of my positions has been that education is not adequate.
It's not quick enough either. They can stretch that out too.
And it's an essential part, but it's not adequate because take the example of we need meaningful legislation to put an end to this nonsense. That's what I'm saying. I'm saying
good for you, Carl.
That,
I agree with you wholeheartedly.
That it was only after there was legislation enforcing people to wear seatbelts that people started wearing their seatbelts. It was only after there was legislation to ban smoking that there was a meaningful change in the public's attitudes. And I believe that the same needs to be for pesticides.
I agree with you wholeheartedly, and it just drives me up.
Now, of course, at this meeting, there's going to be many different views. And one of the positions I take, and I'm sure you agree with this, is that it's so difficult to look at all these chemicals. And I'll give you an example in a minute, that one has to say that even if the evidence is, for some people, inconclusive, we should err on the side of safety.
Exactly. Now, that's the true meaning of the precautionary principle. If there's any possible doubt, then it shouldn't be used. And that puts the safety factor back on the shoulders of the companies, that they have to prove that. And there's no way that they can with the chemicals when there is, let's say, 50 years of scientific research showing how harmful they are.
Now, we're dosing children with dangerous pesticides, and of course they're vulnerable, as are the smaller animals, because a larger animal can, you know, it's a lesser percentage, say parts per million or so, of pesticides. So children are very vulnerable.
Oh, yeah.
And the message not getting through.
Yes, you're perfectly right. Their immunities are not adequate yet to even in adults to deal with these. So how could you expect a pesticide that's been approved
now
for use on a 160-pound man?
Now, earlier on in your conversation with John, you were talking about Health Canada. And I'd like to say that many people feel that we are blindly following the opinions of Health Canada and not realize how in bed they are with Monsanto and Dow and all these large corporations.
Oh, definitely.
And I have a statement here from Robert Cohen, who is speaking out on the different size of animals that, you know, proportionately, animals would suffer more, cats and dogs, than a large animal. And he says the Environmental Protection Agency, he talks about their mathematics.
Yes.
And he says, is on one level both dyslexic, hovering between unethical and criminal. Would you agree?
I would say they're largely balanced over on the criminal. This is criminal what they've done to the people. We've actually been sold a bill of goods.
Now, the bill of goods that I was being sold last week by a company called the Weed Man, and
yes.
I let them give me a quote on my lawn, and then when they phoned me back with a quote, I started asking them about what pesticides they were used, and I was told that they're totally harmless, non-toxic. So I said, well, what are they using? So they said, simulated growth hormone. What do you know about simulated growth hormone?
Well, I think that actually, you could refer to these pesticides as hormones.
Right.
They have a hormonal action.
So
now, 2,4-D is actually a pseudo-estrogen chemical.
So when she says this is a simulated growth hormone, it could contain a horrendous pesticide, 2,4-D, which is what we want to eliminate.
That's what will be. If you look at the label on any container of pesticide herbicide, pesticides is a general term. Herbicides is the one that is referred to as a weed killer. Now, 2,4-D was used in the Vietnam War. It was 50% of the concoction called Agent Orange. And every formulation that says it kills weeds on a lawn will contain 2,4-D. And usually two other, what they call the phenoxy herbicide family, which are Mecoprop and Dicamba, they usually put those three chemicals together in it. And yet they have to maybe put that on the label, but not the warning. The warning just says keep out of the reach of children, which to my thinking means only don't let the kids have the spray bottle.
But what about the lawn care company? I mean, you just let them go ahead and do it.
Oh, well, that's just what people
you
do
don't,
blindly.
There's no label involved?
No, people just trust them, and it's a misplaced trust, but in the process, of course, they put everybody in jeopardy. Because you cannot contain a chemical on a lawn and keep it in your yard.
Now, this affects the entire food chain, I suppose, the birds, the worms, the insects, you
well,
know.
Well, like Rachel Carson wrote about Silent Spring in 1962, which is over 40 years ago. And at that time, she said, with the DDT, which was one of the very first big chemicals that were used, it only took 10 worms exposed to DDT to kill a robin.
Wow.
Now, it's you can extrapolate from that just exactly what happens then. I mean, everything, it doesn't dissipate. They'll tell you it's magically gone, but if you put it on the lawn, it's going to eventually go down into the soil with the rain on it, and then it comes up in the roots with the roots of the plant. Take it up, so it's up in the grass.
So human health is declining because of these increased levels of pesticides, which take many decades to disintegrate. And it's basically, as I see it, because those people who make the important decisions aren't necessarily the ones who bear the brunt of it all.
Oh, it's handled at the top level by people who are, as you say, in bed with the chemical companies. We found years ago, if you're a good guy at the top, say in the Department of Agriculture, you can easily get a very good job in a chemical company.
Thelma, this is Margie.
And they're sort of...
I'm just wondering, what is the most promising route for a person who wants to get rid of these chemicals to go? Would it be pressuring the local government or writing to Health Canada? What do you suggest?
Well, with the court case that they had back east in Quebec, and it took them 9 years to go through the courts, they got the government to admit that the municipal governments could look after the health issues of the people that live in their municipality. Now, this is a health issue.
I see.
It's a neglected one. It's one that, unrecognized one, ignored. And yet, it's to my research shows me that we are all being affected, and that's why our children's hospital even is full of kids.
You mean
Because you can put down the problems that happen to children these days can often come through the use of exposure to chemicals. 95%, according to the American Cancer Society, of chemicals that are used on lawns can cause cancer. So that's the American Cancer Society saying that.
And we're seeing a lot more cancer in children all the time, aren't we?
Children never used to be born with cancer.
Born
when
with
my
cancer,
kids were
yeah.
small, I didn't even know of anybody with cancer. And then I didn't know if you heard of a case of cancer and you talked about it, and it was usually in someone that was getting very elderly. You didn't hear of it in children. No. Now it's so commonplace that nobody blinks an eye.
So it used to be a very rare disease. Now it's an epidemic, all under the watchful eye of the Canadian Cancer Society and other such institutions. Well, they should be fired.
Well, they put out a pamphlet. I have a pamphlet from the American Cancer Society that says this, that it is that 95% of them are cancer-causing chemicals. Mm-hmm. Now, Port Moody, when they put their ban into place on the cosmetic use of chemicals, there was a letter came into the paper, a letter to the editor from the Canadian Cancer Society saying that these are very dangerous to everyone and shouldn't be used.
Mm-hmm.
So why aren't they making that more public? I mean, the Cancer Society collects money, millions and billions of dollars a year, haven't found, quote, a cure. I mean, sometimes you get remissions. Often those remissions can be caused by changes in people's use of conventional doctors to alternative. And yet they know that so many of the cancers are environmentally produced.
Yes, but then you're up against the big boys, aren't you? And they don't like to tackle those. Now they take on the safe issues.
Everybody's
smoking now, you
know. Everybody's chicken, even the municipal. The municipal councils are afraid that they're going to be sued, taken to court by the big lawn care companies, who, of course, bring in their big guns. And we've seen it happen. Vancouver, when we stopped the use of 2,4-D on the parks years ago, they had the big guys come in from the States fighting it.
We need to have a program in place where chemicals and substances that are to appear in the market will be tested with conclusive tests, not these fraudulent animal tests, because they're just wrecking everything.
Now, right now, the safety data is supplied by the manufacturer.
Mm-hmm.
Now, hey, that's pretty basically stupid.
Yeah, that's conflict of interest.
Of course, and we're not talking about a minor detail or a minor item. We're talking about something that's
just. We got one minute left here. I just wanted to note that the pesticide minimums are are lower for humans than they are for animals. So the feed that is going to animals can have a higher level of pesticides than the food which humans eat. But of course, the fact remains is that these chemicals bioaccumulate in the animals, and that when people are eating these animals, they're getting this gigantic dose of pesticides as well.
What these people forget is that man is the top of the food chain. And all these chemicals are what they call biomagnified as they move up. They start with the feed, they start with the soil, they start with the whatever eats that. Like, say, let's talk about seafood. You get it in the water, and it gets into the feed, the small fish, then the big fish, then the bigger fish, and so on and so forth. That's why it biomagnifies.
Thanks very much, Selma, for all the information. We've got to go now, and I really appreciate your coming on the air.
Anytime.
Thank you.
Thank you.
That was Selma McAdams, and she's an activist on pesticide for pesticide reduction and works often with Health Action Network Society. Well, that brings us to the end of our show. I want you to stay tuned for Deconstructing Dinner, which is up next, and it's about
Terminator
seeds and Canada's officials and bureaucrats pushing it on the world market and using all sorts of devious methods in order to abandon the precautionary principle and adopt one of risk management. Nobody knows what the hell the risk is. So stay tuned for that on the Green Monkey. You're listening to CFRO 102.7 FM, and this has been Animal Voices. My name is John Pranger. Thank you.